This is Packer and Durham on ACCN and SiriusXM Channel 371.
They are having a big time in Raleigh, North Carolina, because NC State punched their ticket yesterday to Omaha in dramatic fashion, really kind of shocking the college baseball world. You've got two games today, Virginia and DBU at 1 p.m., and then tonight, Notre Dame, primetime at Mississippi State. Great venue, front and center. Our next guest will be there. Taking care of business. Kyle Peterson joins us. First of all, Kyle, always a pleasure having you on the show. I know you'll be chilling out, hoping the weather's going to be good. But, man alive, what a day for the ACC yesterday, right? Virginia back against the wall, great pitching effort. Notre Dame, what you saw, just destroys Mississippi State. But the shocker was in Fayetteville, an Arkansas team as complete as there is in college baseball. They don't lose a series all season long to any SEC team. However, their season ends with Kevin Copps on the hill, and they lose to NC State at home. What a stunner that was.
Yeah, it was. You know, when the news came out that Arkansas was going to start Copps, first of all, I think it was a pretty clear indication of what they knew, that what they were in for. But then NC State just kept taking punches. They got beat 21-2. I mean, you guys know this, but 21-2 in the opener. And I'm sorry, but if there was many after that thought that NC State was going to come back and win 2 1-run games and take every single punch that Arkansas had outside of that dugout, I'd be surprised that there was many. But that's all it takes, man. I mean, it takes 27 guys in that dugout, and it takes a coaching staff to believe in them. And that environment, and I had that game going on the computer and then our game going on here on the other screen at the same time. And sometimes I felt like I was just going like this the entire time to look at both of them. But it was a crazy setting. It was a crazy setting. And they beat a kid yesterday that, to me, it's the most impressive pitching season I've ever seen in collegiate baseball. Copps was that good this year. They beat him.
Kyle, when you look at it in the scheme here, Elliott Avent took a team out there 8 years ago that had Trey Turner and Carlos Rodon and, you know, kind of was the building block. This NC State team's got a different story to tell. You don't start 1-8. You don't write the, hey, let's go win one of our first nine and make it to Omaha. I mean, that part of this team, I think, actually helped them after they lost 21-2 on Friday night in a weird way.
It has to some extent. I mean, you know, it's not necessarily we've been there, done that, but being in that environment that bad is a little bit different. But there's a lot of similarities. And I think, too, I mean, I never played for him, but I've been around him enough. man, Elliott's just got a different way of keeping guys loose and happy and understanding that the task at hand doesn't necessarily matter what happened yesterday. And it's a great personality for Omaha to see again, because I think that the job that he's done with that program, they are so consistent year in and year out. And I know they haven't been at Omaha maybe as much as the fan base would like, but that is a consistent program. And, man, they can hit. I know there's some questions about their pitching staff top to bottom, but there are zero questions about that offense right now.
Kyle, as a guy that played at Stanford, give us a little sneak preview, because you're going to get NC State Stanford this weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, they're offensive. There's some similarities, actually. I mean, Stanford is as offensive a team as they've had in a long time. I mean, if you go down and beat Texas Tech at Texas Tech this time of year, you have to be offensive. Yeah. There's no other way to beat them. But they really pitched it down there. I mean, they got a complete game in the clincher and shut down a Texas Tech offense. You know, they're not going to show you 97 from the left side at the end of the game like NC State does, but they're going to fill up a strike zone. Brendan Beck's been there for a long time. I would assume that's who NC State is going to get in day one, just a in and out. The stuff has ticked up a few, but a strike thrower that can do whatever he wants with the baseball whenever he wants to do it. But it's an offense that is as complete as I've seen Stanford have, and I don't even know how long. But so you see offense against offense in a ballpark that doesn't give up a lot of offense. So there you go.
Yeah, it would be kind of an interesting fit for TD Ameritrade Stadium in Omaha for sure. I want to pivot to what you've seen the last 2 days in Starkville. I look at the way the ball game sets up here, and Notre Dame, you know, the pitching is fine, but as long as the bats stay warm, is it that simplistic for the Irish of Link Jarrett?
Can be. I mean, they've scored 17 runs in two games, and that was only enough. Eight in the opener, they get beat by a run, and then obviously yesterday they take the early punch. That was what was most impressive to me. And we talked to Aiden Tyrell, the left-hander, about it afterwards. So you're in that environment. Notre Dame's the home team yesterday. So Rowdy Jordan's coming up. He's the first hitter of the ballgame. First pitch, bang, he hits a triple to right center field. The dude's going crazy. People are on their feet. Smoke's all over the place. The very next pitch, Tanner Allen hits a sac fly to center. And two pitches into the game, bang, bang, it's 1-0. And now you got the fans into it. You got the environment to it. Mississippi State got one more guy in scoring position the entire game from that point. So Tyrell was that good. Just at controlling State's offense. But Link Jarrett said it when we talked to him yesterday in the in-game interview. I mean, the easiest way, or maybe it was Lamontis that said it, the easiest way to keep their crowd out of it is to keep them from scoring. Because if they're not scoring, the crowd's not going to get invited. And as the game went on, it was less of an environment. It was less of an environment, which is understanding. I mean, that's what happens in those situations. So for Notre Dame, they've already seen it. I mean, and they haven't been wowed by it. That has really impressed me. It feels like they have fed off it more than anything else. But, yeah, the offense has been the story so far. I think you're going to see some Mississippi State runs tonight, too. That's not an offense you can keep down for very long.
Kyle, the way Notre Dame's hitting the baseball, I mean, it's one thing to do it at home and you outscore people 50-5 and it's your house and you hit 15 home runs. You mentioned the fact that they've kind of walked into that environment and said, okay, cool, this is neat, let's go have some fun. You know, they've had 17 innings of having the bat in their hand. They've scored in 10 of those 17 innings. I'm not sure Mississippi State's really figured out a way to get them out so far.
No, they haven't. They absolutely haven't. What I like about tonight is just the way that yesterday broke down. Both sides should have loaded bullpens. And I would assume that Kohlhepp's ready to go tonight. He threw 78 pitches in the opener. I think he can probably get 3 to 6 outs. That was David LaMonta last night. How about this? Notre Dame has had home runs from the 9 slot in their order each of the first two games, and it's been two different guys. I mean, you want to talk about lengthening a lineup up. If your 9-hole guy's going deep back-to-back days and it's a different dude both days, you would take that. And Tyrell yesterday figured that slider out. When he figured that slider out, Mississippi State kept going after it. He punched out the side in the third. At one point, he punched out 5 of 6. Now, he only punched out 6 in the game. But 5 of 6, and the biggest was leadoff single for Forsyth in the third, and then he struck out leadoff, 2-hole, 3-hole. He struck out Rowdy Jordan, Tanner Allen, and Cameron James. And that set the tone right there because it felt like leadoff man on top of the order coming up in the third. Mississippi State didn't get anything, and they really didn't do anything else offensively the rest of the day.
Kyle, before we let you go, I want to pivot to Virginia here. 5-0 in elimination games in the NCAA tournament so far. And yesterday, Griff McGarry goes 7 and strikes out 10 in a 0-0 game. And then all of a sudden, you know, it kind of opens up in the 8th and the 9th. Kind of a bizarre scene, period, with the neutral site and all this. And then you get two great efforts pitching yesterday. I wonder where Brian O'Connor, this particular team especially, how they handle this moment now with that vibe of being undefeated in elimination games.
Well, clearly they're comfortable in this spot. It's not necessarily the spot that you want to be in, but they're comfortable in this spot, and I think it's just a credit to Oak and Kevin and the way that they run that place. But the outing yesterday for McGarry looked like a big leaguer. And I don't know whether it was a gun burp when he hit 101 or whatever it was, but, I mean, he was living 95 to 98 with a hammer slider, and when it was in the zone, they weren't going to do anything with it. Yeah. And they needed that. They needed a starter to go deep into the game. I was surprised I didn't see Shock get up yesterday. I would hope there's not any issue because he's kind of taken America by storm lately. but it'll be fun to watch, and I'll be watching. I wish that environment was a part of it. It's really not going to be. I mean, there's fans there, obviously, but it's going to be different when you're playing neutral site. But, again, you look at the season that NC State had, and you look at the season that Virginia had. I mean, Virginia had to get hot the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks of the regular season to even get into the tournament. NC State was in a similar position. Now one of them already knows they're going to Omaha, and the other one's 9 innings away from potentially doing the same thing.
Kyle, take NC State away, because anytime you go on the road and knock off number one, it's a big deal. And it's amazing now, the last number one national seed to win the national championship is Miami in 1999.
Yeah.
That's just kind of bizarro, right? Other than NC State, of the teams that have punched their ticket into Omaha, what to you has jumped out as, wow, that was not necessarily surprising, but impressive in the terms of the way they took care of business? Is it Stanford, just because the pitching was so good?
I don't know this for fact, but I don't think anybody has ever won a Super in Lubbock except Texas Tech. I'd have to go back and look. They don't lose at home. They just don't lose at home, and they really don't lose at home in a postseason. And Stanford punched them in the mouth two straight days. I mean, it wasn't even close when you go look at it. So, yeah, I think that was the most surprising. You know, what's interesting when you look at Vanderbilt, that, I mean, they won, I think it was 2-0, 4-1. Like, it took Kumar and Jack Leiter being really good for two straight days. But I tell you what, man, if you go look at Tennessee, aside from, you know, maybe the first eight innings against Wright State, you go look at Tennessee the last 2 weeks, and Tennessee's scary right now. And they think they're really good, and they are right when you watch them. So it'll be fun to see that. We haven't seen that orange in Omaha in a long time, maybe since Chris Burke was there. No, it was Hochaver days, so call it 15 or so years.
Yep. Yeah.
But that makes it better. That makes those types of fan bases, the NC State larger fan bases, the Texas fan bases, that makes the environment better. I'm looking forward to seeing them all.
Yeah, good stuff, man. Keep up the great work.
Kyle, I got to tell you, you mentioned this. I'll finish with this. It almost feels like Omaha and Stephen Schock need to kind of meet at some point, don't they? I mean, it just feels like Schock kind of needs to be in that environment.
So cut me off if you need to here. I understand the way television works. But so I interviewed him. We interviewed him preseason. And I knew the kid's name, but I didn't really know his story. And it was, you know, Zoom like we're all doing right now. And I, first of all, he wouldn't – you cannot get a short answer. You got to know that when you're going into an interview with him, which is awesome.
Right.
But I didn't necessarily know it. And so everything is drawn out, and he's telling all these stories. And, man, I got off that call. I'm like, this kid, I don't know how good he's going to be, but more people got to know about him. Because, I mean, when you talk to somebody and every time you get done talking to them, they give you a smile, that's somebody that you want to be around a little bit more. And that kid, and aside from the fact that he spent big time at the back end of the bullpen for him, but, man, he's just fun. And, yeah, it would make him better.
One more thing, Kyle. Yeah. It's got nothing to do with ACC Network, but it does have everything to do with college baseball. I want to go back and just bring up something. Kevin Kopp, just as a gut-wrenching loss as you can possibly get for a guy that's such a great, great pitcher. The fact that he's signing autographs an hour after the game, is he not like the perfect snapshot of what the game needs to be? I mean, you want to win. You want to compete. Yeah. You do it the right way. But at the end of the day, this guy's going to have hopefully a great career. But I was really touched with, man, that to me, I've never met him, never spoken to him. I've watched him play a bunch. But, man, when a guy sits there and suffers as tough a loss as you can possibly get, and yet he wants to get back to the fans afterwards, that's where college baseball needs to be. That's exactly what it needs to be.
That's who he is. I mean, everybody's going to talk about the wins and the saves and the strikeouts and everything else, but he's an unbelievable leader. I tell you another one that we're not going to see in the postseason that's similar to that is Tim Elko from Ole Miss. We're not going to see him. Elko played the last 3 months of the season on a torn ACL.
Yeah.
Those two guys embody what you want leaders to look like, and they just happen to be really, really good at baseball at the exact same time. But yeah, I saw the pictures. I think Hunter Yurecek, the AD from Arkansas, sent a picture out of Kevin signed autographs an hour afterwards, and I can't say that it shocked me. I haven't been around the kid a little bit. We had him on set at the SEC tournament this year. He was fascinating. But I'm not exaggerating. It is the best collegiate pitching season I've ever seen in my entire life, ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's what that kid did and the number of games that he affected it's unparalleled for me.
And it makes NC State's achievement even that much greater. The fact that they can get beat 21-2, know what's coming in that environment and go WW and do something that not a single SEC team figured out all year, and as great as that league is, and that is win a series against Arkansas, NC State. That I'm telling you, it's one of the best wins in their program's history, regardless of sport.
Yeah.
No, agreed. Great stuff, nobody Kyle. Else could figure them out, and they did. Gents, I enjoyed it.
Yep.
Enjoy the run at Omaha.
Yep, so did we. Always appreciate it. Kyle Peterson, he and Dave Neal have the call tonight from Starkville with Notre Dame and Mississippi State. Sit tight. Two-a-days with Packer and Durham is next. We go to Central New York. Stephen Bailey, who covers the Orange for 24/7 Sports, will be here. And we're going to look in on Syracuse and Dino Babers. A difficult season a year ago. What's it mean now coming into 21? There are some new names and some new faces, but there is a lot of young experience taking shape. The Orange is next on P&D, presented by New York Life.
The Packer and Durham Podcast. Here's Mark Packer and Wes Durham.
Packer and Durham, presented by New York Life. 844-SAY-ACCN is the number for the program. All right, Wes, this is the first installment of our two-a-days. We'll take a look at ACC football,
right,
getting you ready for not only Media Days, which gets cranked up in about 5 weeks here in Charlotte, but also the season, which I believe is about, 70-some-odd days away from 75 days from kicking off. So it's sneaking up on us, which is beautiful. But we will take a look at two ACC football teams each and every day moving forward. And we're going to begin in Central New York, where the Orange joins the mix in the fray here. Stephen Bailey joins us to talk about Syracuse. And Stephen, first of all, it's always a pleasure having you on the program. And number two, there is a lot of work to be done here. What happened last year is rearview mirror, but it's kind of time for Dino and the boys to turn this thing around.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way. I think there was a sense of urgency going into last year. And obviously, the pandemic affected everyone. I think for Syracuse, it was especially bad. They hired, you know, Dino hired two new offensive coordinators. He switched schemes on defense. So he was trying to pivot, and then he didn't get a spring ball, and he didn't really get summer workouts, and a bunch of the offensive linemen got injured before or during preseason camp. And, you know, then the schedule switched, and instead of opening with a couple easy games at home, you're on the road against North Carolina and Pittsburgh, and then you go 1-10. So the pivot kind of needed an extra year. I think that sense of urgency is really in place now, and I think internally they're hopeful that with a full offseason they're able to accomplish some of the things that Dino wanted to go out and get done last year.
All right, Stephen, it's easy to say let's start with DeVito and the quarterback spot and things like that. I want to pivot off of that. I want to go to the number one concern Dino Babers has in this offseason, and I'm going to guess it's Sterling Gilbert's offensive line. I've got to guess that and believe that wherever Syracuse is going in 2021, it's going to have to start with those five guys up front.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. It's funny. Everyone likes to point to that 2018 season as like Eric Dungy's year. They had their six basically starting caliber offensive linemen. They rotated their guards, stayed healthy the whole year. Like that hasn't happened since 2012. And it's, you know, it's no surprise that since 2012, no Syracuse quarterback has gone the whole year being healthy. Ryan Nassib did that before Syracuse was in the ACC. So Syracuse went out this year and tried to stock up on the offensive line. They got Jacob Bradford, a junior college guard tackle, and they got Willie Tyler, a Texas tackle transfer, but he just decommitted basically right before he was supposed to come to campus. So a little bit of an issue there. It looks like it's, you know, Syracuse is going to surely try and go out and replace him, but I think it's going to be a lot of the same guys trying to take a step forward from last year. And, you know, I think it's hard on the outside to really say after a pandemic year how capable they are of getting better. I heard a lot of good things out of spring ball, but that's not the same as fall. And, you know, it's a lot of like third and fourth year guys. It's like, are they going to make that jump or are they not going to get to a point where they can really compete in the ACC? And I think we're going to find out this year because I don't think they're going to be able to bring in a guy who can be a week one starter this late in the cycle.
Steven, keeping the quarterback upright has been a problem, needless to say. 38 sacks allowed last year. But isn't it hard to believe that we're now into another year of the Dino Babers campaign and we're questioning the offense? I mean, I would get it if Syracuse was struggling, and yet every game felt like it's 55-50. But it's hard for me to believe that we're talking about, man, what's wrong with Syracuse's offense, right? It doesn't even sound like it makes any sense when you start talking about any Dino Babers coach team that offense is an issue.
Yeah, it's surprising, especially based on the first couple of years, because they did put up some points with some bad offensive lines. I think there's a number of factors that come into that. I mean, going up against, you know, when Dino came in, he kind of had the element of surprise and he was able to scheme some things up. A lot of the opposing defensive coordinators he's seeing now are familiar with his system. Obviously, schematically nationwide, right, teams have learned how to play against the spread. You're seeing, you know, five-man secondaries and hybrid linebackers and safeties who can cover and all those things work against it. But internally, aside from the line, you know, quarterback depth has been right there. Those two things are connected. Syracuse is hopeful that it has two Power 5 quality quarterbacks this year. They went out and got Garrett Schrader from Mississippi State. He was here in the spring. Someone who's probably able to handle pressure a little bit better than Tommy DeVito, known as a playmaker. His high school tape is filled with him extending plays and running and throwing on the run and, you know, doing some of the things that made Syracuse fans fall in love with Eric Dungy. I don't think he's going to be able to come in and just fill those shoes, but I do think they have two quarterbacks who can hold up for the first time since that 2018 season.
Okay, but let's pivot to this. If it all comes back to the offensive line here, and we agree it does, then the run game has got to be established. And Sean Tucker, when healthy, I thought did a really nice job. After all the uncertainty about the position when the year started, Stephen, Tucker, as long as he stayed healthy, did a really nice job, I thought, when given that window.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I think he was really impressive, and I think if you put him behind a good offensive line, like he would have made, you know, maybe not national headlines, but he's someone who people would have been aware of outside of Syracuse and the ACC. I heard he had a really, really good spring. You know, I think he is going to take a lot of people by surprise this fall if the offensive line takes a step forward. And that's, you know, like we've said, that's the big question. I think if there's room for Sean to work with, he'll do well there. I think some of the issues he had as a freshman, largely pass protection stuff, I think just comfortability out there, those are going to go away with experience. He was running a lot harder in the fall, or excuse me, in the spring. So, yeah, I'm right there with you. I think Sean Tucker has the potential to be a really good running back in the ACC. And with a little bit of room, like he has the vision. He has really good instincts, and he falls forward. He's just the kind of guy that he made something out of nothing last year, and I think if they can give him a little bit to work with, he could really surprise some people.
Steven, on the defensive side, I thought Syracuse last year, despite the record, had some moments where, you know what, the guys played okay. They got some guys, some playmakers, and you could kind of sense that, hey, you know what, they're about ready to turn a corner on that side. I'm assuming, again, you tell us, that Syracuse on the defensive side of the ball feels probably a little bit better than they do on the offensive side.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, I think Tony White, the defensive coordinator last year, did a pretty darn good job considering he got no spring and the guys were working in small pods over the summer. So he basically had to evaluate guys while game planning and, you know, doing everything all in fall camp. It's really an impossible task to get a group fully ready for that. And I understand that he's not alone in having to do that. There are other first-year coordinators last year who ran into similar issues. But, you know, they switched to the 3-3-5. I mean, it's very different up front. They were running a 4-2-5 previously. You know, you got guys going from DN to strong side linebacker or, you know, sliding gaps. You got, you know, people moving around in the secondary based on new responsibilities. It was a lot, but I think they did do a very good job, and I think this year they're poised to take a step forward. That linebacker group, I think, has a ton of potential. Mykel Jones led the nation last year in turnovers contributed to. Absolute playmaker, guy who's really, really good in space, good communicator, has the trust of the guys around him, and he's only a third-year player. But look at Marlo Wax and Stephon Thompson to make jumps in their second years. I think the D-line had some issues in run support last year, and I think a lot of that is the schematic change. They're older guys, they're seniors, but they went from playing in like a read and react scheme to a movement-based scheme. So just working out some of those habits of like, you need to like fire off the ball, you need to go. Like, you don't worry about what the running back's doing. Like, you need to be there and trust that the guys behind you will cover up. I think spring allowed them to do that. So I think the D-line will get a little bit better. It's the secondary where the real question is. They lost three guys to the NFL early, and they're going to be young guys back there. And how ready they are will play a big part in how successful that defense is this fall.
All right, Stephen, let me ask, though. Here's the thing. Garrett Williams, Jahad Carter, Rob Hanna all made plays last year. I mean, Williams had the pick six at Clemson. Carter seemed to be a really good guy in run support, playing middle of the field when they asked them. When they went dime, I thought that's where Carter and Hanna both stood out. Williams was a down-in, down-out guy. I wouldn't be as worried about the secondary. I mean, I'm more concerned about the offensive line than I am the secondary. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. I mean, the offensive line, if the offensive line doesn't take a step forward, I find it hard to see them winning more than four games. You can win with some issues in the secondary, but I do think whether you can trust those guys in the back end affects how aggressive you're going to play up front. I think Garrett Williams is the real deal. I mean, there are no concerns about him. Yeah. He's their best guy back there. Jahad Carter, I think he had a prep school year, so he wasn't quite a true freshman in that sense. Physically, he's ready to play that boundary safety position. I think he needed some time to adjust to the speed of the game and some of the angles coming forward. So I think those two guys the staff really likes. It's the three other spots. Rob Hanna is, I think, going to have some competition at Rover, which is the deep third safety. I think Jason Simmons Jr., a transfer from New Mexico State, could come in and make some noise. He just got to campus. Didn't play last year, but because of the pandemic. But a playmaker, a guy who's got really good ball skills, a guy who you could see making good decisions on the fly back there. I don't know that that's where he's going to play. He could end up playing free safety as well. They've got guys moving between corner and free safety, which is kind of like effectively their nickel corner last year. You know, how that all shakes out and who wins the other cornerback job, maybe freshman Deuce Chestnut. He had a really good spring. I do think that would be important in how aggressive Tony White can be up front, because he's got some guys that can get to the quarterback for sure. Those linebackers are really, really athletic. It's whether they can cover up on the back.
All right, real quick, 10-second answer. Is Tommy DeVito a lock at quarterback when the season begins at Ohio on September 4th?
If he's healthy, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Schrader will play this year at some point.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Stephen. Wonderful as always. Appreciate the information. Be well. Have a great summer. See you soon.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Stephen Bailey covers Syracuse for 24/7 Sports. Okay. So you're going to tell me how you feel later about all that, or are you good here?
Well, I was just going to say, I know everybody wants to get off to a good start, but when you're coming off a 1-10 and people are whispering down the hallway that, hey, it's time, that opener at Ohio, listen, it's not going to get any play compared to the national scene with the giant games, especially in our conference.
Yeah.
I can't emphasize how critical that game is, because the Rutgers game at the following week is going to be a fistfight. And I'm just telling you, Rutgers is getting their act together. And I think when you're in that Northeast corridor, the one that I'm not going to say it's a must win, but man, when you're coming off a 1-10, that game at Ohio needs to be a W for Syracuse. I'm just saying, big picture.
Yeah, it does.
Really,
I'm totally with you on that. I think the first four are really big. All the way through the end of September, they have at Ohio, Rutgers at home, Albany at home, FCS ought to win, Liberty at home. Ought to win. Go 4-0 to start. You're feeling pretty good going to Tallahassee in October.
I think you better worry about 1-0 before you worry about 4-0. When you're coming off 1-10 and there's question marks and you're opening on the road, MAC team will be excited to see an ACC team come into their house. Just saying, that's just one of those games you just need to set the tone that, hey, last year's rearview mirror. And that's a really important
game. I got you. I'm with you on that. All right, sit tight. Steve Weissman is next. Don't forget, football season is right around the corner, kids. You betcha. The ACC football kickoff is Wednesday, July 21st. And Thursday, July 22nd, we'll be in Uptown Charlotte. And the ACC Network has you covered. Complete coverage of one of the media marquee events of the year. You won't want to miss a minute of it. We get you ready for one of the biggest ACC football seasons ever. And to that effect, when we come back, two-a-days, we'll focus on Duke and David Cutcliffe's Blue Devils with Steve Weissman, who covers Duke football. For the News and Observer and the McClatchy Newspaper Services, next on ACC Network. Packer and Durham presented by New York Life.
Packer and Durham. This is Packer and Durham, presented by New York Life.
Mountain Lion, 40%. 40% Mountain Lion.
Yesterday, he did play the Mountain Lion role to the script, just like you asked him to. Yep. I'm not saying that's live video, but there's a chance he is back on that box before noon. That's all I'll say.
40% Mountain Lion.
So
there's no doubt in my mind. Yeah. Clifford D. Cat, Cartersville, Georgia. Beware. Proceed with caution.
All right.
Let's talk some Duke football. Let's go D-U-K-E. Yep. It's been busy in Durham from a basketball perspective. But, again, this is part of our two-a-days that we're going to do now for the next week and a half, looking at every single ACC football team. Syracuse started it. We'll finish off with Duke today. Steve Wiseman joins us from the News and Observer. Does a great job covering the Blue Devils. Steve, good morning. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Good to be with you guys once again.
Man, it's been a busy offseason for a lot of bizarre reasons, but now we're going to talk football. And David Cutcliffe and company, much like we just discussed with Syracuse, coming off a season that they're not real thrilled about. But again, that's all rearview mirror stuff. But Duke is the only ACC team that does not return a quarterback with some starting experience. So let's start with QB. What do you think we're going to see with the Blue Devils?
Yeah, I mean, Gunnar Holmberg is the guy coming out of spring. He's been in the program since 2018, but he's hardly played because he missed all of 2019 with a knee injury. And then he played a little bit last year behind Chase Bryce. But even then, you know, he fumbled a little bit too, and he threw a couple of interceptions, and, you know, just wasn't smooth. And so there's a lot of question marks there. You know, normally Duke has a quarterback with experience, you know, coming back. That's what they've always done. The last time they were kind of in this position, you know, last year aside with the Chase Bryce transfer was 2016 when Daniel Jones took over as a sophomore and they went 4-8. So there's a lot of questions there with Gunner. I think he's a better runner than Chase obviously was. The idea is Gunner's got to throw the ball to his team, not like the other team, like we saw so much with Chase Bryce last year.
Steve, this question about Holmberg and what we saw when Roddy and I did the spring practice, if you will, part practice, part scrimmage, was that Holmberg's got the athleticism certainly to make plays on the perimeter, much like what they've had in the past under Cut. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, though. A little bit like Syracuse and the storyline we just had with Stephen Bailey, they were beat up in the offensive line a season ago. When they lost Wallaball before the season started, it was almost like they had to almost – I don't want to say they started from scratch, but they really had to think about kind of the matchups in the front and the way the chemistry and confidence was going to work. Did they make as much progress in the spring with that as they had hoped to?
I think they did, you know, because you're right. At the end of the year, Graham Barton, a true freshman, was starting at center. And – he's going to be moved out to tackle now. So they seem to be strong in the middle of the line. Of course, Wilbaugh's coming off injury. And so everything points to him being ready to go and being the guy they need in the middle of that offensive line. He's going to have to be a rock there because but they have returning guys at both guard positions. They have some experience there in the middle, you know, with Jacob Monk and Gunner Casey Holman. But it's the concern is on at the tackles where you have, you know, new starters, you have sophomores out there that are not experienced in that position and getting a lot of playing time. So those guys are going to have to seal it off and do the job. And that's been a concern protecting the quarterback over the last couple of years here. So they did make progress in the spring. It was important progress because they didn't get, you know, last year, nobody got work in the offseason. And I don't think it hurt anybody as much as it did Duke. They're a developmental program. They need that time to develop players, and it really robbed them of everything they do. So the time they got this spring, the full practice was really important for them.
Steve, despite turning the ball over almost seemingly at will, I mean, seriously, there were times last year you'd watch a Duke game, goodness gracious, just hold on to the football, quit throwing it to the wrong guy. One of the bright spots, though, is at running back. Because I think Durant is one of the best players, not only in this league, but in the country that nobody talks about. He's got speed. He can catch. He can run. He is just a big-time player and a big-time talent.
They need to build the offense around him, for sure. I mean, he averaged 6 yards a carry last year against, like we talked about, like a subpar offensive line a lot of the time. And, you know, when Duke was far behind in games. So he's got breakaway speed. He can run between the tackles. He's got the strength to do that. I mean, this is a guy that came out of a small school in South Carolina, a class A, class 2A type high school, that had he been at a bigger high school, probably be in the SEC now. He would have been recruited at that level. But, you know, Duke was able to get him this way. So he's a really good running back, and they need him to be a big-time player. And normally, you know, they spread the ball around at running back. They like to use multiple guys, but this might be the one year where you see them, you know, really, really feed him the ball quite a bit and let him run.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because David Cutcliffe and his folks couldn't talk more about Jordan Waters and Jalen Coleman in the spring a little bit as Durant's kind of the changeup for Mateo Durant. But I, like you, Steve, I got the impression Durant's going to be on the field a lot. I mean, where we've seen split time in the past, I'm not sure we're going to get a lot of that this fall from Duke because of how good Durant can be.
Yeah, I mean, they've got to establish the run. And it's cliche, I know, but it's a fact of football. You have to be able to run the ball and be a threat on first down running the ball to keep defenses honest. And Durant's a guy that can do that for Duke. They really need him to have a big year.
What about the defensive side? What do you expect from this club in 21?
Well, you know, they lost three guys to the NFL, right? Including those two defensive ends, Dumuke Jay and Chris Rumpf. And so Michael Carter in the back. They return a really good linebacker in Shaka Hayward, and that's a good guy to build around. They're going to be young up front. They're going to have a couple of sophomores probably starting a defensive end. So we got some questions there, but they had guys in the secondary that have played. Not a lot of them have started a lot, but they've played. So they always have guys ready on defense. It's just a matter of getting it together, because last year, you know, at the end of the year, they were beat up and they just got got blown away a lot of times, right? They weren't competitive. And so the big question is, can they regain that competitiveness? Because they lost it last year. And it's really a question for the whole team by going 2-9. But specifically on defense, they've got to be able to pressure the quarterback, and they've got to be able to stop the run.
I would offer you this, Steve. In Lummi Young, Josh Blackwell, and Leonard Johnson, they may have the three oldest guys in the secondary in the ACC on one team. I mean, there are other teams that are going to have a guy maybe or two guys, but they got three guys that are easily fifth-year guys, and depending on how you do the math, they may be close to six-year guys.
And that's an advantage that they have to use, right? They have guys that, again, they've played, and sometimes they've played well, sometimes they haven't. They've had injuries. It's not been consistent play, but they've played. So, yeah, that's a good thing to build around. And Duke's always been strong in the secondary. They've always had guys, they've produced guys that have gone to the NFL. That's not been a problem for them. They've always had players back there. So they call it the coalition back there, right? The Tiger and the Cheetah is attacking. So that's a group they've always been strong at getting guys. They just have to be – they're going to need them this year, especially being young up front.
Well, the numbers 38 and 39 are the ones that pop off the page when you look at Duke, because you've given up 38 points a game and you turn the ball over 39 times. Both of those numbers have to improve drastically. Otherwise, you know what? It's hard to beat people when you don't defend and you turn the ball over all day. It's the worst combination known to man. So 38 and 39 are numbers that, if you're David Cutcliffe in Duke football, those numbers, if they don't get better, it'll be a rough sled. But I got to figure, Steve, they're not going to be at 38 and 39 in 21.
I mean, that was about as bad as it gets, right? I mean, you can really only go up from here. And, you know, they definitely, you know, that's been a point of attention a lot in the offseason. It was last year during the season. They couldn't get it straight. But I do think, again, having a full spring practice, having you know, the off-season workouts, the kids can work on their own, the self-practices they like to do. That's always been very important at Duke. And then you get into August and have a real practice, you know. And you got Gunnar, Colton Holmberg, again, who's been in the program now. This is his fourth season in the program. He played a little bit. His only playing experience before last year was in the Independence Bowl in 2018. Daniel Jones' last game, mm-hmm. Gunner came into the end against Temple. So that's how long he's been in the program. Mm. That should help with the turnovers. I mean, at least he knows the system and everything. And it's got to be better because last year was as bad as it gets.
Yeah, it's an interesting spot. It's an interesting spot for the Blue Devils especially. Okay, opening in Charlotte the Friday night of the first weekend. Will Healy's done a really nice job down there. That's a team they embarrassed, though, a year ago. They beat Charlotte six ways over the top. How big is game one for this Duke team? We just talked about it in relationship to Syracuse. You have the struggles of a year ago. How important to win that Friday night game?
It's massive coming off of 2-9. I mean, you can't go down there and lose that game. A team that even last year when you were 2-9, like you said, they dominated. So they can't – first of all, the team can't go in there, you know, overconfident at all because of the way they played against them last year. They've got to go in there, you know, button down and get the job done because then you've got NCAA&T the next week and then Northwestern and then – and Kansas, another team they should beat. Before you start ACC play, they've got to get off to a good start to put aside what happened last year, to get rid of all those bad feelings about, you know, having such an awful season and get it back going again, because the program is really kind of at a crossroads again, right? They've kind of gone back to being uncompetitive. Like the last year they were, like they were back, you know, before Cutcliffe came, and they can't afford to do that.
Yeah. All right. Steve, thanks, bud. Be well. See you in July. See you next month in Charlotte, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, you guys can't wait to be there. It's going to be fun.
All right. Steve Weissman covers Duke football for the News and Observer, and we appreciate his time being a part of Two A Days. Two more schools tomorrow, by the way, on the program.
Makes sense.
And when we come back, that's why it's called Two A Days, right?
That's right, Wes. Your math today is on point.
Math is spot on.
You are all
That's
over.
Exactly right. So two more schools tomorrow. You get it? And then, look, in six more days, we're done. Works out good. All right. Sit tight. When we continue on this program, we will dive into some of the unsung heroes of the spring. Interesting list here being put together, cobbled by our group. People you think about. We just saw one this weekend, by the way. We'll do that and more when we continue after this. Packer and Durham presented by New York Life on ACC Network.
This is the Packer and Durham Podcast. The Packer and Durham Podcast.
Packer and Durham presented by New York Life. Coming up in less than 10 minutes, Lonnie Alameda from Florida State softball. What an incredible run the ladies had. Almost pulled that thing off last week. Oklahoma in game three. We'll talk to Lonnie and get her thoughts on a great, great season, an interesting season for Florida State. But we've had some unlikely heroes on championship stages this spring, haven't we, Wes? I mean, it's been all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, take your pick. Jose Torres hit a home run in each of the three games in Fayetteville, and he's not on the list. But somebody like Griff McGarry yesterday at great. Virginia, sure, you make the list. Because we talk about Andrew Abbott when it comes to Virginia pitching, right? But Griff McGarry went out there and went seven strong. And to be honest with you, he was winless in five appearances in the regular season with a 7.5 ERA. So when you go out there and set it down for seven, strike out 10, allow two hits, you're on the list, Pack.
Yeah, coach puts you in the bullpen. You're struggling, but, man, they needed him yesterday. Season high, 10 Ks, no gripes, just comes in. Got blood on his pants, blood on his hands, and just throwing strikes. And it was just a great effort. A no-hitter going in the seventh inning in a game that Virginia had to win, and they did.
Yep. I mean, the same storyline applies to Kaylee Mudge of Florida State softball. I can't wait to ask Lonnie in a moment about Kaylee Mudge, because she had 16 hits all year going to Oklahoma City, Pack, and had 14 in the Women's College World Series.
Yeah, and broke the record in Game 3 right out of the gate with the double. And you're thinking, man, Florida State's in business. But, again, give Oklahoma credit. You limit you to two hits in the championship game. But, man, Kaylee Mudge was a tremendous asset and a great story for Florida State.
Yeah. Couple more here before we get to the top of the hour. Lance Tillman of North Carolina. four goals in overtime against Rutgers in the NCAA quarterfinals. He had 10 goals in 16 games during the regular season. I mean, just to show you guys and girls who step up when you get to the postseason and change kind of the characteristic narrative, if you will, of teams.
Yeah, especially
Lance Tillman's a guy who's on your scouting report, but he's not at the top for sure.
Right, especially a team as high-flying as North Carolina was, especially offensively. He comes in and just takes care of business. Again, the unsung heroes are normally the great storylines as you head to hopefully a championship season.
Yeah, no doubt. We can't do this without Turk Pettit, right? I mean, that's unsung. Did you think Turk Pettit would be the guy that if Clemson were to win an NCAA individual championship, it would be a guy who hadn't won since his freshman year?
Jacob Bridgman, yes. Turk Pettit, again, solid year. But, you know, as far as closing the deal and winning the ultimate prize, yeah. And that is an NCAA individual championship, from that perspective, I didn't see it coming. But I tell you what, he earned it and deserved it. And it was great having him on the show.
Hey, by the way, did you notice that in the first picture we show of Turk Pettit, that over his right shoulder is Tiger Luminary Cobb Oxford?
I got to look closer.
Not this picture. Not this picture. The next picture right there. Is that?
I think that's Billy Ray Brown. Played the University of Houston.
Oh, is that Billy Ray Brown?
Yeah, I don't think that's the big man Cobb Oxford, the big man from Anasan. Cobb Oxford, no.
Big man from Anasan. Tiger Luminary Cobb Oxford. That's Billy Ray Brown. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's Billy Ray Brown. University of Houston great.
Separated at birth. Billy Ray Brown and the big man from Anasan.
Yeah, that's what I call Cobb, the big man from Anasan.
That's it, yeah. Well, you know, we got to point out the luminaries on these institutional campuses, don't we, every once in a while?
Well, I mean,
Cobb would be a luminary, wouldn't he?
Well, yes, but it'd be important to actually have him in the picture, though, Wes. I think that's the difference. I mean, you're pointing out a guy that was Cobb. Not Cobb. That's okay. He'll appreciate the love, though.
Hey, it's June. That's right. All right. Let's go off the spring's calendar here real quick. How about Clemson football's Malcolm Green? 6 tackles, 1.5 sacks in the ACC championship game. He only had 7 tackles in 2020 prior to the title game.
Yep. Tigers got after Notre Dame in part two, though, didn't they? I mean, defensively, they had Notre Dame flustered. And by the way, good to see Notre Dame football on ACC Network. Hadn't seen that in a while.
All right. All right, women's lacrosse is next. Rachel Hall of Boston College had a .471 save percentage in the NCAA tournament in goal. She was only 31-9 in 5 games prior to the NCAA tournament. So congratulations to Rachel Hall.
You know, with Rachel, everything about BC was about what? Charlotte North was so explosive on the offensive end. But you know what? You win championships by stopping people. And so it's good that she got some love there because she was tremendous. And what a great story BC was. I mean, just unbelievable what they pulled off.
All right. Before we get to the top of the hour here, Virginia men's lacrosse, great story, right? Ends up with the national championship for Lars Tiffany.
Again.
Jeff Connor had 3 goals and an assist against Maryland in the NCAA championship match. He only had 2 goals and 2 assists in 6 games prior to the NCAA tournament.
Great championship game. Of course, awesome. Maryland undefeated until they saw Virginia. And Lars Tiffany and the gang do it again. Just an amazing run for not only Virginia, but also the ACC, and both the men's and the women's sides claiming the national championship this year and really dominated the whole sport. Really did.
All right, great to have unsung heroes in the spring and really in the fall when you think about it. Some of these stories are just remarkable of people that step up when it comes to postseason. All right, we go to the Power Hour on a Monday, and we do it with Lonnie Almeida, who coached Florida State to the National Championship Series in the Women's College World Series. We will talk to her about getting to the third game. What do you take away from it? And it's a tough night. But when you process it, How does it help your team? We'll do all that more with Lonnie next. Packer and Durham, presented by New York Life on ACC Network.
This is the Packer and Durham Podcast.